This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello. I am Tom Daly, and welcome to The Exchange. I am fortunate to have been able to catch up with Roy Field Brown, a first-rate podcast producer and a whirlwind of humanity. Roy Field is a man spinning many plates, and though he was the Agora Podcaster of the Month in May, it wasn't until mid-June that I was able to track him down and talk with him about the state of podcasting in 2016, and about several of his shows, including, but not limited to, Dumpty Dum, How Jamaica Conquered the World, and 10 American Presidents. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'm pleased to introduce to you a man who lives vicariously through himself, whose business card simply reads, "I'll call you," whose Cinco de Mayo parties begin in March, the man who was once pulled over for speeding and gave the officer a ticket, the man who, when he's in Rome, they do as he does, and the man who never wears a watch, because time is always on his side, Roy Field Brown, the most interesting man in podcasting. Roy Field Brown, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Thomas.
It's my pleasure, as always. You are here today. This is sort of the Lost Exchange episode. You were the podcaster of the month for May. However, because of your international 00 status, we were not able to track you down effectively until now. But glad you were able to join us.
Well, thank you for putting up with me being somewhat missing in action, so to speak, last month.
It's fine. It really is. We're just so happy to have you. Well, let's get right down to it. Now, I want to start by putting your podcasting career in some sort of context. It seems like podcasts really caught on in the late aughts. That's the, 2008, 2009. When did you come on the scene?
I started podcasting in 2012. I was working. I just sold my company the year before, and I was then working for the company I sold my website to, and I found myself commuting to work for the first time in 15, 16 years. And on that commute to work, that's when I really discovered podcasts. And then 2012 was the year when it was Jamaica's 50th anniversary of being an independent country. And being inspired by the history of the world in 100 objects, by the history of Rome, by the Thomas Jefferson Hour, etc., I decided, well, why don't I do something which celebrated that? So really, 2011, 2012 was when I was bitten by the podcasting bug, having to commute to work, and then I decided to podcast.
That's so funny. Commuting is actually one of the big ways that I myself got into podcasting. I wonder how much that actually affects people, because, you know, when I had a 5 or 10 minute commute, yeah, I never really thought about taking the time to, you know, find a show, download it, you know, pop in earbuds and deal with it. But, you know, when my commute got to be an hour or so, you start looking at things differently, don't you?
Absolutely. And they describe one of the kind of podcasting listening phenomenons is they call it the driveway moment, where you drive home, but you're at a real crucial bit of the podcast and you won't get out of your car. You'll stop on the driveway, that extra 5, 10, sometimes 15 minutes before you actually go home. I had that, but it was the it was me not walking into work. You know, I'd be listening to The Complete Guide to Everything, which is a comedy podcast, and I would be outside work. Sometimes it'd be kind of raining and you have to be under the awning listening. So you just wanted them just to finish this one little wisecrack about something or some skit that were going on before actually going into work. And that is the power of a really good podcast.
That's very true. It's about engagement.
Absolutely.
Now, you are a digital strategist, a marketer, a promoter. Out of all these things that you do and you can do, what is it about podcasting as a medium that has really captivated you as a producer of podcasts?
I think because it's still relatively, it's relatively speaking, it's still the Wild West. As a medium, podcasts are what, maybe just over 10 years old, but really they've kind of caught a second wind in the last 2 years with the advent of Serial. I know it's a somewhat tropey thing to say, but it is true. The success of Serial means that kind of everybody who is computer literate has now heard of a podcast. That, for me, for somebody who thinks somewhat scatologically, means that it's a very fertile ground for working with clients and getting their messages out there. So some of the two or three of the podcasts that I actually do, I am a paid gun for hire. And it's really good to be able to just experiment with the genre, with the format, and use it as a way to get kind of marketing messages out there, to try and capture kind of user loyalty and engagement, you know. And I just find that absolutely brilliant. You know, the rules around radio shows are pretty much written in sand. You know, you got various legislation or broadcasting laws throughout the world. Or if it's print, you know, that size of that newspaper is physically the size that it is, etc. And every other page has an advert. Podcasting, you can still make those rules up. What actually is a podcast? And I just find that, as somebody like me who loves marketing, loves developing brands, to be a totally exciting kind of medium to be working in.
Absolutely. And hate it or loathe it, we are in the post-serial podcasting world. And you still refer to it as the Wild West, though I think certainly larger conglomerates and businesses are starting to also wake up to the fact that podcasts can sort of be a tool for themselves as well. Now, you've got a nice, generous, broad perspective. Kind of looking forward in the next 10 years of podcasting, what do you see the state of the medium being?
I think there's going to be many more large brands that are going to come on and either sponsor whole runs of shows or actually kind of create their own. And kind of the analogy that I think which is closest to this is contract publishing. And I worked for a contract publisher. It's like my last proper job, really, before I developed my own website back in 1998. And I think that, as I said, I think that is the closest model that we're going to have with podcasting. So contract publishing is magazines that look after, let's say, a specific industry, or it's a company that publishes their own magazines. Now, in the UK, we have a really successful retailer called Waitrose. Waitrose is a supermarket, grocers, but very high end. It's a middle class wet dream, basically Waitrose. If where you live has a Waitrose, your property price has gone up automatically by 10-15%. So Waitrose, for the last 10 years, have had their own magazine. And it's that good, that glossy, that it sits in newsagents all over the UK. It doesn't feel like a mouthpiece just for Waitrose, but it is. It's incredibly glossy, well put together. So if you to translate this, you know, in terms of the way it would put together in terms of a podcast, it would be like This American Life, incredibly slick and an engaging magazine. And you can buy it. And even though it's called the Waitrose magazine, it doesn't say go down to Waitrose and go and buy your spuds or your carrots. It's just a really good read about with cooking recipes, with lifestyle pieces. But very subtly within that is a message that you can go and get this stuff at Waitrose. But they never explicitly say that. I believe that's going to be one of the ways that podcasts will go. So it would be, let's say, Red Bull doing a mm-hmm. podcast. And it's all about extreme sports and keeping fit. They don't have to mention Red Bull once, because actually that podcast is about the lifestyle ethics actually of the brand. So that's going to be one way of which large companies, brands will actually go into the podcasting sphere and actually create programs. And I think then that creates an opportunity or a problem, whichever way you want to put it, for people like us who are, let's say, enthusiasts. And I kind of have a foot in both camps, because I do 10 American Presidents, I still just about do How Jamaica Conquers the World, and I do Dumdy Dum. So there are three podcasts which I get some money for, but it's not at all a livable wage. But so with that hat, then how does somebody like me, who is an enthusiast, fight against the fact that there's going to be marketing muscle behind Red Bull or creating a whole load of podcasts? So it means that people like me need to be much more creative and individualistic about our podcasts, at least they stand out, or kind of bandy together with like-minded podcasts to kind of to create networks. And I think that those networks will be much more solidified going into the future. So there'll always will be, let's say, a Dan Carling, who will be big enough as an individual just to swim out there by himself against the kind of the advertising branded kind of podcast. But then there'll be a whole plethora of kind of networks, and then there'll be weird and wonderful eccentric podcasts out there as well. But that's the great thing about it, is the fact that nobody really knows. This medium is still really developing. You know, it almost feels like, if there's an analogy to radio, we are in the late 1920s, where the standards are really just being laid down, really. But still, maybe the Wild West is maybe slightly the wrong analogy. Maybe the Wild West was still another 3 years ago. But definitely in terms of, if you looked at radio as a parallel medium, right here and now in 2016, we're probably in about the late 1920s.
Now, I think I speak for countless Americans when I ask you this next question. Who the hell are the Archers, and what the hell is Dumpty Dum?
So, the Archers is the longest running continuous drama in the world. It's been running for 65 years. It's produced by the BBC, actually in my hometown of Birmingham in the UK. And it's a rural soap. It's on 6 days a week. It's 12 minutes in length. There is one actress who's been in it from the very start, though she actually played a different character. So it started in, 1951, 52. I fell in love with it on Radio 4 in the late 1980s. Radio 4 is a rather peculiar British institution, BBC radio station. It's speech-based. It's kind of NPR, but posher. And The Archers is a show which somewhat feels slightly out of place on that radio station. They have very high-powered kind of discussions and news debates, etc. on there. And The Archers has kind of been batted around on the BBC schedule in terms of its different radio stations ever since its inception in the early 1950s. So it's a rural soap. The Archers are a family of which there are fundamentally two main branches, arguably three on the show. They're all farmers, and I just love it. And I discovered that show in the in the early 1980s as a rebellious teen in Birmingham when I discovered Radio 4 and this world of intelligent speech-based radio.
Typical with my teenage rebellion there, you know.
Well, I know.
And I'm going to listen to talk radio.
Well, being from where I grew up in Birmingham, which was is a relatively working class, upper working class city in the United Kingdom. And I was always I've always been into geography and history. I was always being fascinated by why is America the shape that it is? Why is there a big straight line between America and Canada? Why does a bit of France jut out into Germany? And that's the Alsace-Lorraine, all this kind of stuff. I was just fascinated by looking at the globe and then history. Now, a lot of those answers I discovered actually on speech-based radio, on Radio 4. I was always I've just always been into media ever since I was a small kid. My father, in the 70s, had Super 8 cine films, so he'd be making his little cine films. And then I was chopping up bits of audio with twin tape decks in the late 70s, early 80s, not knowing I was in effect audio editing. I was just playing around. So I've always been interested in technology, media, history, geography. I'm basically a functioning dyslexic. So what I didn't do was I didn't read an awful lot. What I did do was I listened. So Radio 4 was just perfect for me. It was this world where people like Melvin Bragg were on there talking about stuff, and it opened up the world to me. So my teenage rebellious years were listening to electro hip hop in my bedroom and then switching on Radio 4 and then falling in love with The Archers, and then some 30 odd years later, with my digital marketer's hat on, I said, wait on a minute, the Game of Thrones is the most talked about TV program in the world, and there are probably, let's say, 15 podcasts dedicated to it, and let's say each week 20 million people listen to Game of Thrones. I don't know what the figure is, but let's just say, for argument sake of argument, is that I watched The Walking Dead, and AMC released their figures after each show goes out, and it's maybe about 16 million watch that. There are countless podcasts to it. In the UK alone, each week 5 million people listen to The Archers, and there's 1 million podcast downloads from around the world, and there is not one show dedicated to it. So for me, as a digital strategist, it was obvious that if you did a podcast around The Archers, you had a ready-made audience, because there's 1 million people who are downloading that, so are conversant with the internet, whereas the typical demographic for The Archers in the UK anyway is old middle class, white and rural. But if you can get your head round, of which 1 million people do a week, downloading that podcast, well, you are going to be somewhat proficient on the interwebs. So it was just an open goal, as you know, for me it was just obvious to do this. And then it will give me another platform, in that people at the BBC will be listening to my show, which is absolutely what we do know that they do. So we've had actors from The Archers on our show, we've had script writers on, the BBC frequently retweet what we do, and on our 100th show, which was in March, we recorded it actually at the BBC, you know, in front of a live audience. So that is, in effect, dum-de-dum. I do it with a co-host, Lucy V. Freeman, who's a comedy writer. I say hello, hi, and welcome. She cracks all the jokes. It's very light-hearted. The Archers is a drama, is a soap opera. But ours is very much a comedic take. But we do love this thing, and people call in. And the lovely thing is about dum-de-dum is that we've managed to create a community which sounds like a somewhat trite thing to say about your show. Oh, we've created a community, but we really have. Each week we have at least 10 people that call in, and that's at least, and it's from all over the world. So we have a psychotherapist from New York who analyzes the motivations of the characters each week. We have a summarizer from Australia. We have a regular caller from Kenya. And one of the beautiful things about doing Dumdy Dum is that, yes, I'm somewhat itinerant, so I'm in Toronto right now, but I've done mini meetups in Toronto. I've done quite a successful one in San Francisco, kind of my second home, where we had some 12, 13 people turn up. We've had meetups in New York and, of course, in London, because whenever I kind of get off a plane, I'll tweet, this is where I am, and then people say, oh, let's meet up for a drink. And then if we do this formally through the show, you know, we can get together, you know, whether it's in London, anything between 15 to 80 people, or whether it's in San Francisco, we'll still get, you know, 12, 13 people turn up to our Dumdy Dum meetup. So it is a global community, which we've kind of fostered through our love of the Archers.
That is absolutely amazing. But I want to move in.
You should listen to it. Not Dumdy Dum, the Archers.
I'll put that on my list.
Put it to the top of your list, Thomas. I've got a sneaky feeling that was just said just to throw me off the scent somewhat.
Well, Game of Thrones is in the middle of the Game of Thrones season, so I'll get around to it.
It's 12 minutes a day. That's all it takes of your time. And basically, this is Game of Thrones without the sex. I was going to say without the violence, but we've just had Helen Titchener stab her misogynistic husband, and she's in prison now, just giving birth to a baby. So she's on an attempted murder rap. So there is violence in the Archers, not much, not normally. But you imagine Game of Thrones without the medieval setting, without the sex, with a little bit of the violence, but in tractors, you've got it. It's exactly the same.
Done. Yeah, I just want to move in more of my comfort zone and talk a little bit about 10 American Presidents. Mm-hmm. So the name is pretty self-explanatory, though. It doesn't really encompass, you know, the entirety of what the show is about. For instance, you've done a episode about Colin Powell. You've done the Monroe Doctrine with Zach Twomley. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how 10 Americans came to life and how it's evolved.
Okay, so as is the way with having West Indian parents and being brought up in the UK, my family is scattered all over the globe. And my grandfather, my father's father, lived in New Orleans until about 3 years ago. He passed away in 2013. Mm-hmm. I visited him for the first time in 1996, and I remember, as the plane took off, it was about 2 or 3 hours before England were due to play Holland in the quarterfinals of the European Championships. And I was saying, as much as I want to go to America, my God, this important football match is on at that time. And as the plane was about to land, the pilot said, so it is 23 degrees in New Orleans. Please adjust your watches to the local time, which is whatever time he said. And for those that are interested, England beat Holland 4-1! Like this, and then the plane landed, and the whole plane kind of erupted and went, hey! Like this. And so that was kind of welcome to America for me. And I visited my grandfather. And literally the next day he said, right, grandson, we need to go to, and I forget where, wherever to get whatever. And I said, well, how long is that going to take? And he said, oh, it's going to take half an hour in the car. And I said, I beg your pardon. And he said, yeah, we've got to, you know, and I was struck by the size of America. I forget what we had to get, but insert relatively trivial object into your mind and then think we had to travel for half an hour to go and get it. And I said, this is just ridiculous. And I realized the size immediately of America, even though I've been looking at it on the map. And then whilst we were traveling in the car, I heard this guy rail against President Clinton. The president is a fraud. We should impeach him. He's lied to the American people. Who is this bum? Blah, blah, blah. And this guy wasn't somebody who was calling in on the show. He was hosting the show. And I was absolutely transfixed. And I just thought to myself, my God, this would not be allowed in the UK. You know, we have rules about balance in broadcast media. And you just cannot say such a thing. You know, at best, that would be somebody calling in, of which the presenter would say, please calm down and remember to keep this civil and et cetera, et cetera. It was absolutely enthralling, Thomas. It was only about maybe 10 years later, on the run up to the 2008 election, that I realized I'd been listening to Rush Limbaugh. And I didn't agree at all with what this man was saying, but it was really entertaining. And I remember saying to my grandfather, why are you listening to this guy? And he says, the man's an idiot, but it's entertaining, you know. And that was my first real introduction to American politics. It was a slow burn, really. Then there was the Hanging Chads in 2000. But really, it was the 2008 election with the election of Obama, which I kind of looked at America really with new eyes. And there is a tradition that there's a tradition in European culture that says that things in America are somewhat bastardized and not, what's the word I'm searching for? This goes way back. And I was listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and they were talking about the fact that European thinkers at the time of Jefferson would say things like, the American colony, people in the American colonies will not thrive physically because of the lack of proper livestock in the New World. There were all these theories about that, and all these kind of thoughts, erroneous for the most part, that things in the New World were not as good as the old. And that kind of goes deep into a European kind of dismissiveness of American culture. And I kind of had that as well, i.e. America has no history. And you kind of realize that if you look at the formation of nation states, America is actually one of the oldest. So really what you're talking about isn't a lack of history. It's a lack of continuous culture is what people are talking about, because America is older than Germany, is older than Italy as a nation state, older than just about every country in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, so what I've noticed, I think many people define the beginning of the modern era as the French Revolution. And when you look at it that way, the United States is as old and as well established and as much history as any modern state does. The only thing that I would argue that we might lack are sort of those tyrannical bonds of history in many ways.
Mm. Yeah. And actually, even the fact that it's the notion that the modern world starts with the French Revolution is actually to do down America. Because in lots of ways, really, the founding of the modern world should be the American Revolution. It should be. Because a lot of the themes of the French Revolution are there in the American Revolution. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And also, it sets up this large, independent country, which is going to be massively important in world history. It sets it up, you know, it's going to be massively important for the next 200 years. So, I came to America with a typical European view that this is a place which kind of lacks history, and was absolutely bowled over by understanding, or having an understanding, I'm not saying I understand it, but having an understanding of the founding principles and the fact that America is exceptional in many regards, but definitely is exceptional in this one regard, in that it is a country founded on principles which are not to do with necessarily with place and with ethnicity. So I'm British because I was just born in Britain. I'm just British. There is nothing to being British other than just born in Britain. Ditto the Italians, the French, the Russians, the Chinese, and literally every country under the planet. However, Americans say that you are a true American if you believe, let's say, in freedom of speech. It's an article of faith that there are certain elements that you believe in democracy. Now, Britain can be a republic tomorrow and can be a communist country the day afterwards. It's still Britain. America would be fundamentally different if it had a different, or the notion of being American would be fundamentally different if it had a different form of government. And actually, it can't have a different form of government. And when I sat down and kind of realized this, in the run-up to the American election of 2008, I said, this is a fascinating place. So that's really where my love of American history and the political machine kind of came about. And understanding it really from a British perspective, what was fascinating, because even though you take so many elements of your culture and your history, obviously are derived from the fact that these were ex-British colonies, the way that your government is structured is so different from ours. And forget the whole Republican monarchy thing. You just put that to one side. Mm-hmm. But we, to have your Congress, which acts as a check and balance against the Senate and the presidency and the judiciary, the UK, and again, just every other major European country is not set up in that way. So we have a loyal opposition in the UK. And they barrack the government all the time. In the United States, yes, you have opposition, minority parties in the Senate and in Congress, but they're still all notionally within government. Mm-hmm. You know, we again, in the United Kingdom, we don't have that. The leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, is in opposition. He would not say that he is in government at all. And it's to understand that you have, there is a certain sclerosis to American politics which is built in. Things have to move slowly. There are checks and balances all over the place. And where bits of government are in direct conflict with each other, they're independent but in direct conflict. And I just find this absolutely fascinating. And you have this political culture which is very confusing for a European to look at. And then increasingly in the last 8 years, you've had the level of political disaffection and vitriol as well. So I just find the whole thing absolutely fascinating. And so come a couple of years ago, I said, right, after I did my series, How Jamaica Conquered the World, which technically isn't really finished, but the truth of the matter is I do one or two shows a year now. I said to myself, I need to devote my time to looking at American history, because at that time, there weren't a lot of podcasts devoted to American history. Jamie Redfern hadn't started his. And yes, there's a lot of PBS stuff out there, but there weren't a lot of American podcasters doing American history. You hadn't come along by then.
Nope.
And if you look at, and I think it's another kind of, this goes to play up this notion of America not having history, in inverted commas. And I don't want to disrespect Native Americans here. But the group of people that came along who founded your country came from somewhere else. So they took on the traditions and they looked at their and their antecedents are from somewhere else. That's just fact. So I think it's not by accident that you have somebody like Jamie Jeffers, who's American, but he does the history of England, the British history podcast, sorry. You have Stephen Guerra, history of the papacy, because you know, so many of you Americans have clear antecedents somewhere else, that you are in love with, by definition, European history. And you see that, and you see knights and Romans and Vikings as being something which you have this emotional and historical attachment to, and that is history in inverted commas. Again, Mike Duncan, History of Rome. Dan Carlin didn't focus on looking at American history, so it was relatively speaking an easy decision to make with my love of American culture stroke history, and then trying to understand how this peculiar place came about where notions of economics and governance are tied up with ideas of identity, that I really had to do it. So the landscape now has moved a little now. So you have the American Civil War podcast by that husband and wife team. There's your show, Thomas. But back 2 years ago, there wasn't really too many American history podcasts. And I just wanted to do it. But I wanted to do it in a different way, And that's one of my bugbears about podcasts, really. Just do things in a different way. Don't just read books and regurgitate the books. Try and create your own spin on something. So that's...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That's really how I came up with it. And sorry for talking for so long.
That's all right. Now, you have seemed to focus more heavily on presidents. And so far, you've covered Nixon, Franklin Roosevelt, Jackson, and George Washington. Who are the others that you have lined up? And which of the 10 grabs you the most?
Right. I'll answer that in reverse. Initially, of the 10, FDR, he was probably the president which I knew the most about because of the Second World War. So you, as a British school kid, you'll learn about FDR. Coming up, we have Obama, but we're just going to do his election in 2008. Mm-hmm. We have Jefferson, who I find an absolutely fascinating figure. A listener who's now become a bit of a podcasting chum, Adam Vanami, has done Grant, and he's actually the 11th in inverted commas. Obviously Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Reagan, and Kennedy. Those are the ones which come in. And the whole idea is that I'm not saying that they are the most important, and you on Facebook kind of help clarify somebody that said, you're doing the best. And I've never said these were the best presidents, but they're the most important or instructive in terms of understanding America at a certain time, or they are absolutely pivotal. So, Reagan, you can't understand Reagan has been absolutely massively important, not in terms of just understanding the modern right of American politics, but also setting an international tone of liberal economic theory. That's Reagan. Also Thatcher in the UK, but that's Reagan. So you have to do Reagan, full stop. Kennedy is important because of the romanticism of the presidency. You know, this young, good-looking guy, gunned down at his prime. Look at the way that things could have been. And he's the first of the modern era of presidents in terms of he understood the televisual medium. And, of course, there's the famous Kennedy-Nixon debates. You've got to do Kennedy, even though I've got a lot of love for Johnson, to be honest with you, which is a somewhat controversial thing to say. But in terms of getting things done, he got things done, but he's hung on the whole Vietnam petard. But civil rights, Johnson got things done, you know, and he was a politician of the highest order. And because of that, people kind of walked backwards from Johnson, but he made those deals. He was, you know, nakedly a politician, but he got things done. Look, I love Truman as well. But, you know, we're not doing Truman per se, but we just did a show on the 1948 election. Going back to presidents, which you have to do. But maybe the one president which I didn't know, there's two presidents I didn't know an awful lot about at the start. Actually, Teddy Roosevelt. I knew a bit about him. And then the other one, which I didn't know an awful lot about, actually was Jackson. But you got to do Teddy Roosevelt because... he redefines the American presidency after a whole slew of what, literally 40, 30 years of almost placeholder presidents. You know, he was this muscular guy in terms of personality that was definitely a man of action and redefined the American presidency.
Yeah.
Of not just being somebody who just rubber stamps things and actually kind of gets things done. And then looked at corruption and you know, and corporations and big business. So absolutely a fearsome kind of guy. And that's before you look at him shooting sick bears and then having them kind of named after him. And you know, and this kind of understanding of environmental issues, which kind of comes about through his presidency. Obviously, you have to do Lincoln, say no more. And then I think from a European perspective, doing somebody like Jackson is absolutely fascinating because Jackson is the first president who is not built in the mold of the founding fathers. So he's not an intellectual. He, you know, is from the backwoods and is a self-made man. And in effect, he is the American dream. And he's the first, in inverted commas, ordinary American who is not from some kind of plant aristocracy family, who by dint of his sheer will and strength of personality fights his way into national consciousness. There is no way that, if you look at the presidents beforehand, you know, he's not from Virginia or anything like that. And he is a self-made man and he gets to the, he becomes president and a wildly popular one, not forgetting that he's in effect really one of the people and builds a cult of personality around him, built on his image of having wild hair. And, you know, you see somebody now running for the ticket to be the president of America. The part of his shtick is the fact that he has the kind of distinctive hair and is fearless and is a populist and some might say a demagogue also. But you kind of understand this whole idea that, you know, anybody, you know, any boy, any girl can, you know, can aspire to be the president of the United States. And you kind of see that first crystallize in the presidency of Jackson. So I think I've kind of just about done everybody apart from really talking about Obama to say that the reason why we're doing Obama is because it's been somewhat normalized, the fact that your president has a skin color which is different from the vast majority of people that live in your country, because we're used to it now. To say that this was an earth-shattering event for this to happen is to put it mildly. And I say this to people all the time, that this is the first time that a Western country has had somebody who is racially not from the minority who's the head of his executive. This has happened in Peru. Alberto Fujimori in the 1990s, was ethnically Japanese and is the president of Peru. But Peru is a Western country, but it's not one of the most powerful countries in the world. Americans, whether you agree or not with the politics of Barack Obama, you need to pat yourselves on the back and to say that, you know, you have done this. Because we are, though the world and America is not at all colorblind, this sends out a very powerful statement, a visceral statement to the rest of the world about who and what America actually is. And that's one of the reasons why Obama, whatever the polls say in America, I know his approval rating is about 51% at the moment, so he's quite popular. That's the reason why Obama is so popular throughout the rest of the world. And I know Americans don't really see this, because they see, at least Republicans anyway, will see him as somewhat as a divisive figure, and because they see the politics. But screw the politics, the symbolism. People in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, etc., were so excited about this, and it said so much about the idea of America. So you have to do Obama's election. No, we're not going to look at his time in government, but we're going to do a whole show around the election. And there were election parties in the United Kingdom, and people didn't have any skin in the game. That's how important that election was to the rest of the world. You know, here was this telegenic, articulate guy who was who had actually spent time outside of America as well, you know, kind of growing up. So we're going to do Obama. Mm-hmm. And I love Thomas Jefferson, because you understand, again, from a European perspective, your gun laws make no sense. Well, not from a European perspective, from an everywhere on the planet perspective, your gun laws make no sense. Now, I'm not going to say whether I think those are right or wrong. You can probably guess by me saying they make no sense where I sit on this. But
I take a guess.
But if you don't understand the American Revolution, then that Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, then makes that's the reason why people don't understand it. Whether that should be in a modern society, whether people should be walking around with guns is another thing. But to understand those theories of the yeoman farmer, the yeoman citizen, the fact that we need to balance individual rights against the state, against the centre, that's Thomas Jefferson. You know, and the ideals of what America is politically, philosophically, is Thomas Jefferson. And then at least you have an understanding of the Second Amendment, and you know, kind of comes from him, and just the theory of the Republic. And Thomas Jefferson is obviously a lion when it comes to that. You know, so those are the reasons why I'm doing the presidents that I am.
Excellent. And I think the other really fascinating feature of 10 American Presidents would have to be your series of guest hosts. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the biggest names thus far have been Dan Carlin and Mike Duncan. Who else do you have lined up? Are there any big surprises?
So we've had Zach Twormley, and I must admit, don't ever tell him, because I know no one listens to these exchanges, but I'm actually a little bit of a Zach fanboy. And just indulge me for a second. It's one thing to be able to research really well. It's one thing to be able to put together, to produce a show. But I think not enough is actually made of the voice of the podcaster. You become that person's friend through their voice. You become incredibly close and attached to that podcaster through their voice. And there is, and I just think Zach is absolute gold. So I asked Zach to do me an episode, and he did. And so what I'm trying to do is, obviously, I want people to come along and narrate the life of a president. But as you kind of hinted at before, the scope of the shows has gone beyond the big man view of history in terms of this is President One and he did this, and this is President Two, he did that, etc., etc. So what Zach did was the Munro Doctrine, and what I'm trying to do is go to other podcasters who I respect and say, let's do a show which reflects your show, and we'll put that in 10 American Presidents. So When Diplomacy Fails, for me, is just a brilliant podcast, because I think Zach is almost wasted on podcasts. He should be in broadcast media. I think he's just, he has a great delivery, a great understanding of the subject, and it creates a great all-round product. So we decided to do the Munro Doctrine, and then we could put that in 10 American Presidents without necessarily talking about all of the legislation which Munro enacted or his time in president, time in office, sorry. So we've got Zach, we've got you coming up. I've got David Petruccia. Actually, you coming up is actually really important, because actually a hero of mine is actually is Hamilton, and this is before the hip hop musical. So to do Hamilton is absolutely brilliant, because yeah, like a lot of people, I am fascinated about the founding fathers and the way that you Americans kind of lionize them, even though they're incredibly flawed and conflicted individuals. And Hamilton is just a great one, and arguably in terms of Jefferson, the Hamiltonian, the America that we have now is Hamilton's America with Jefferson's guns. That's basically it, really. So you're going to do Hamilton. David Petruccia is somebody who I bumped into, who has done FDR, and for me, it's probably my favourite episode. I know a lot of people say Nixon. And it's a bit of a toss-up for me. So Dan Carlin did Nixon, Mike Duncan did Washington. Dave Petruccia, I hadn't heard of David, but on the Facebook group, two listeners, when I said, put out a message saying, who should I reach out to get to narrate a show? And I believe Stephen Guerra said David Petruccia, but definitely somebody else did as well. And I contacted him. And he's written a couple of books about FDR and about the 1932 election, the 1948 election, the 1964 election. So he's a historian and author of repute, and he has an amazing turn of phrase. And so he did the FDR show for me. I've got lined up notionally. I have Robin Pearson said he will do something, though we're trying to figure out what exactly that is, because I'm trying to marry up the shows with something which chimes with what that narrator also does as well. Now, anyway, I am. Sharon Eastor also says she would do something. So we might do a one-off show looking at America's involvement in the Middle East. So at least then there'll be echoes back to the Crusades. We have coming up crumbs. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do with Stephen Guerra, actually, and I've been mulling it over in my mind before I actually reach out to Steve. But Steve, if you're listening, maybe if you can have a think, sir, we'll kind of get something going. One of the reasons why the presidents have not been done in chronological order is because it very much is a do you want to do this, pick your president type of thing. Rob Monaco has also said he's going to do one as well. And I think I've just found somebody to do Reagan. So I bumped into an author. I won't reveal his name just yet, but quite a well-known author has written a couple of books about the Reagan years, who's very conversant behind a microphone. He's done a lot of TV interviews and stuff. But we're just going through the logistics, and he'll probably end up doing Reagan. And then also, Kennedy is going to be done by Daryl Cooper of the excellent Martyrmaid podcast. And what I love about what Daryl does is the fact that he puts so much of his own thoughts, theories on the world, basically, into his shows. And he's a very powerful thinker. So I'm really looking forward to him doing Kennedy. Dave Petruccia will come back and do, I think he's going to do Teddy Roosevelt. And one of the many great things I love about doing 10 American Presidents is the fact that it has spun off. So we have done various other things, and we're doing a mini series within it called 10 American Elections. And David Petruccia, with kind of listener now podcasting bro Adam Vanami, are very upfront and kind of central with that project. And we just recorded yesterday the 1948 election, which is the famous one where Truman beats Dewey, but the Chicago Times or the Chicago Tribune, I forget which one it is, prints
Dewey defeats Truman.
Exactly, and there's Truman holding it up and whatever. So and they just work excellently on that, you know. So David is the point man, but Adam is the color commentator. I literally asked, if I asked 7 questions in that 1.5 hours, and the pair just had a conversation, and it was just something to behold, you know. So yeah, there's 10 American Presidents for you.
Great. I think we're gonna start wrapping up now.
No, let's talk some more. Well, talk about me.
Well, actually, that's where I wanted to go. Now, as of the recording, from what I've seen on social mm-hmm. media, you are looking to move from the UK to the United States. Mm-hmm. What's that process like?
Tortuous. So, there are various visas. I started the process in London. Let me go back a step. So, I've had this long, slow love affair with the United States, which I didn't even realize was a love affair, and really until 2 years ago, and it really bit me on the bum when I came to I decided just to go travel the world for a couple of months. Went to Toronto, saw my kids, and then I said, right, I'm going to go to an American city. I'd already been to New Orleans and New York, and I said, right, I need to go somewhere else. And I said, I almost went to Chicago, and said, no, right, I'm going to go West Coast and San Francisco. And within 12 hours of being there, I said, this is the place for me. I love it. I love cities. And one of the other podcasts I do is this thing called The Urbanist for the New Statesman, which is all about cities and how they work and how they're the most environmentally friendly way to live, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. It's an urbanist dream. Love that. But it was only this year I decided, right, I need to emigrate to the United States after me spending 3 months, 2 months in the preceding year kind of in the States. So there are loads of visas potentially which I could go for. I could even call myself an alien of extraordinary ability. There is a visa even called that. Wow. You know, which if
you
won
highly of ourselves, do we?
So if I won some kind of award, if I've won a Nobel Peace Prize, all right, I can just walk into America and under that visa because I'm an alien of extraordinary ability. It doesn't have to be just be a Nobel Peace Prize, obviously, mm-hmm. but if I've won some kind of significant award. But then there are various kind of media ones which I believe I could kind of qualify for. So back in, I think, February, when I got back to the UK after spending 6 weeks in North America, I went, right, I'm going to go for this. And it's absolutely bewildering, Thomas. So what I've decided to do, I'm just over here still on a tourist visa, but I'm speaking to a lawyer who deals with immigration right now, who's going to work it all out for me. So it's going to be somewhat of a long, tortuous process. I believe I could go for the Alien of Extraordinary Ability one. I say there are 2 or 3 other acronyms for media ones which I believe I would qualify for. I could get a sponsor, etc., etc. But what you don't want to do is apply, make a mistake, which then precludes you then from going for another visa. So instead of me doing it online and trying to work it all out myself, because when I looked at the one visa, there were 36 pages of stuff for me to fill out. And at that point, I said, I'm not qualified to do this, because if I make a mistake here, you know, I'll be somewhat upset. So suffice to say, I'm no expert, but my lawyer is. And, you know, let's come back and see where we are in a couple of months in terms of my whole process of me getting residency in your wonderful country.
Well, it's really that torturous process is really just getting you ready for a series of torturous processes that citizens have to go through, like going, to the Department of Motor Vehicles and things like that. So it's good practice.
Well, I look forward to that unalloyed joy of being an American citizen.
And I think the final question I have for you today is, mm-hmm. Now, historically, waves upon waves of people have migrated to the United States, either seeking better economic opportunity or maybe an escape from the ancient political tyrannies which have oppressed them. But, mm-hmm. I mean, you live in, most of the time, 21st century United Kingdom, which I think is hard to say, famine ravaged or something like that. It seems to be a very pleasant place to live. What's the modern first world individual's motivation for moving to the United States?
The truth of the matter is that if I was born in San Francisco, I'd probably want to move to London. This is no demerit on the United Kingdom about the fact that I want to live and work in San Francisco. And I want to live and work in the Bay Area in San Francisco, as opposed to America per se. No disrespect to Boise, Idaho, but I don't want to live there. No disrespect to Louisville, Kentucky, but I don't want to live there. There's an interesting point. There's a kernel of an interesting point in what you're saying when you said 21st century. And I am a digital native. And I can work anywhere on the planet. But I myself, like a lot of us, choose to live and work around people who are like me. And people who are like me, who are very comfortable having three or four different labels. I'm English, I'm British, I'm Jamaican, I'm European, I'm Western, whatever, can kind of float around. As I said, I love London. I still own a home in London. My kids live in Toronto, well, in Burlington, just outside of Toronto. I need to live somewhere where English is the primary language, because I can't speak another language. So I think I'm a 21st century citizen, really. It just so happens that I'm also an urbanist, and I really enjoy the physicality of being in and around the Bay Area, in terms of culture, in terms of opportunity, in terms of architecture, etc. So for me, there are certain cities which are not interchangeable, but which are similar. So London is similar to New York. San Francisco is a little bit different because it's physically smaller, but in terms of the outlook of the people that live there, it's not massively dissimilar. It's an overwhelmingly liberal place, socially liberal. It's very open, it's inviting of new people, and that's kind of somewhere where where I want to be. It's the reason why I feel somewhat comfortable in Toronto. It's the reason why I feel somewhat comfortable in London. So as I said, just to repeat, this is not that the tyranny of the living underneath Elizabeth II's England, I need to get out, I feel persecuted. It's nothing like that. It's just a case of why not go and live somewhere else and see a bit of the world? Why not? Fortunately, I'm in the position where I can kind of do that. So that's what I want to do.
Well, Roy Field Brown, Amerophile, international man of mystery, podcaster.
Not really a man of mystery. I think I've laid everything bare out on your show, sir. There's nothing more to me. Pretty threadbare, I would say.
Oh, I would have held on to that title as dearly as I could.
Well,
but thank you very, very much, sir, for joining me today. It's been a fascinating discussion. Is there anything you'd like to plug before we finish?
I tell you what, I just listened to a couple of the History of Islam. Actually, very good. So that's what I want to plug, the History of Islam. Even though, and I'll say this somewhat controversially, even though they don't like me so much, go listen to Thomas Jefferson Hour. Clay Jenkinson does an amazing podcast. And if you are, whether you're American or European, it's a great way of discovering the founding principles of America and why America is the place that it is. And the other thing about the Thomas Jefferson Hour, which for me is really important about podcasts, and I've kind of half mentioned this before, is that they've taken a topic, but they've actually presented it in a very unique way. And I think more podcasts should do that. You know, it's one, you know, so you've got your history of Rome's, you've got your history of Germany, your history of wherever and stuff, and the first raft of kind of podcasts, you need that to cover the bases. But then I think it's beholden on podcasters to have a little bit of creativity and originality and to create their own topics. And it's one of the reasons why I love When Diplomacy Fails, because you know, it's what led up to the war. You know, there aren't too many books that kind of say that. They talk about the wars, and yes, they might have what you know, a little bit of what led up to it, but he's put a whole kind of series together, and the Thomas Jefferson Hour is definitely one of those. In terms of, let's take a topic, it's Thomas Jefferson's, you think it's the big man theory of history, but he dons the mantle of Thomas Jefferson and answers questions on America here and today, in not just with a Jeffersonian outlook, but being Thomas Jefferson. It's brilliant, and it's very unique. The history of the world in 100 objects, which I know us history podcasters like to talk about in independently run podcasts all the time, but that is a major milestone in terms of podcast, in terms of history broadcasting / podcasting, but also in terms of very informative for me. And so if you haven't listened to that, listen to Mr. Ferguson's The History of the World in 100 Objects, which was a BBC podcast about 5 years ago. Absolutely fascinating. And they look at things like a coin from Damascus in 620, and how that denotes the fact that the Arabs have just invaded, and how, and then they look at the fact that here is the head of the new Arabic ruler, but on the back, so it apes the old Roman coins, but then on the other side, on the obverse side, is Arabic script. Absolutely fascinating. And again, it's just a way of taking a topic but having a sideways glance at it, which is easily enjoyable and digestible. So I would say, if I'm plugging anything, American Biography, because I need to suck up to my host.
Absolutely.
Zach Twormley, When Diplomacy Fails, The History of Islam. The other scary thing about The History of Islam is I think the presenter is only just out of nappies, out of diapers, just last week. And
sorry, I'm sure Elias will appreciate that.
he's a young guy. He's a young guy. Yeah. I'm somewhat slightly old in the tooth now, but he's quite young. And you'd never believe it by the rigor of how he addresses his topic, and also by just the baritoneness of his voice as well. He's very good. He's got a big future ahead of him. The Thomas Jefferson Hour, and as I say, I somewhat upset. I'm going to just say it now. I don't really care. We're at the back end of this podcast. I somewhat upset the host, Clay Jenkinson, by going on his show last year, and somewhat ruffled some of his feathers, so to speak. But I apologize, Mr. Jenkinson, but he's never got over it. But it's a great show. And then the last one is The History of the World in 100 Objects. So those are my takeaways. You know, too many people say The History of Rome and Dan Carlin, so they don't need any more plugs. Martyr Maid, Daryl's Martyr Maid. Go listen to that as well, because here is somebody who has a very strong and independent view on the world. And he looked at the Arab-Palestinian conflict. And it's one thing which I think a lot of Americans are actually blind to, the subtleties and the nuance of the Palestinian position in it. It isn't just a case of Israel good, Palestine bad, and to have an American who really understands the Palestinian position and the frustration of the Palestinians is something to behold, but to put it in a way which is still accessible and still fair to the Israeli perspective as well. So go listen to that, you know, good independent podcaster with a strong view and set of visions and a fearless kind of podcaster. So those are my... Oh, and the Agora Podcast Network, Thomas. People should listen to that. All of its output. There you go.
Roy Field Brown, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Alrighty, I hope you enjoyed that talk with Roy Field Brown. Make sure you check out his wonderfully produced shows. You can find 10 American Presidents and How Jamaica Conquered the World on iTunes, Acast, and any podcatcher worth their salt. And to find out more about Roy Field and the services he can provide you, check out royfield.com, because this gun's for hire, even if it's just for dancing in the dark. And the last thing, I just want to mention that if you're enjoying listening to Agora Podcast Network's original content, please leave a review on iTunes. Not just for The Exchange, though I certainly do appreciate that, but for any of our collaborations, or just for this collective effort of ours. They make us feel like we're making an impact, and it will help get us noticed, so thank you in advance. So until next time, I'm Tom Daly, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.